And welcome back to Regionally Speaking. I'm your host, Dee Dotson. Despite worries over the impact of President Donald Trump's blanket tariffs against U.S. trading partners, job growth was stronger than expected in April. Joining us now is Ersheng Leung, an economist with PNC Financial Services Group, to share a local, statewide, and national economic outlook. Ersheng, as always, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Thanks for having me again, Dee. My pleasure.
As usual, we would love for you to provide an update for our listening audience, potentially those who are in the jobs market. What is the situation of the U.S. labor market? And are firms still hiring into the second quarter?
Yeah, indeed. I mean, the first jobs report in the second quarter was much better than we have expected. I mean, we expect 150,000 jobs, and the consensus expectation was at 138,000 jobs. But it did came in adding 177 jobs for the month in April. Again, most jobs added were with the private services industry. That was over 150,000 jobs added for the month. And the unemployment rate was also very stable around 4.2% and unchanged. If you look at historical levels, the unemployment rate in early 2025 is still very, very low. And education and health services industry, that added 70,000 jobs. I mean, that industry is less cyclical, not really responding to much of the, you know, for example, like interest rate change, like manufacturing industry. So goods in producing industry added 11,000 jobs in April, with most gains or majority gains in construction, but actually small job losses in manufacturing. Freight transportation utilities, that added 32,000 jobs, but we do expect, you know, some of the logistics sectors, including, you know, where workers at new dock workers, longshoremen, truck drivers, they are going to feel the early wave of trade impacts, you know, some of the tariff impacts after the Liberation Day in early April will start to kick in and bite with perhaps, you know, declining ships coming in, for example, to the port of Los Angeles. And if you look at imports by vessel shipping weight, the ports that import the most from China, you know, the port of LA, port of Long Beach, and in port of New York, those places are going to see a significant decline in ships coming in fewer traffic. And the average work week, we'll likely to see some decline as well. In fact, the 3 months average of the work week is still near its lowest level in almost 15 years. I mean, firms often cut hours before they cut employment. So the softness in the average work week could be a leading indicator of a slower job growth ahead. So outside the trade, transportation, utility sectors, government employment actually rose by 10,000 in April. That was with an increase of 19,000 at the state and local levels. And that increase more than offset the federal government job losses of 9,000. You know, with the Department of Efficiency cutting federal employees, the federal government employment has fallen by 26,000 since January as job cuts under the Trump administration take hold. But as of now, I would say some of the job cuts are more muted, because if you look at the overall number of government employment, that's still increasing and state and local governments are still adding jobs. But we do expect that efforts and cuts will pick up later this year. And that's because, you know, some of the workers who took severance packages are still counted as employed and then will eventually show up in some of the jobs report later this year. And so overall, we think the April jobs report came in better and firms are still hiring. And there is no indication yet that higher tariffs or federal government spending cuts are leading to widespread job losses. But there are some risks out there, as I, for example, stated with some of the port workers. And at PNC, we expect the labor market to soften noticeably through the rest of this year as, you know, tariffs weigh on the economy. Tariff is a form of tax. I mean, job gains will slow, although outright job losses are not expected, and unemployment rate is set to increase in the months ahead to about 5% over the next year.
So let me ask you, the Bureau of Economic Analysis GDP report shows the U.S. economy contracted in Q1. So is the U.S. economy falling apart? And what is PNC's view and expectations moving forward?
So, yeah, we did get the GDP report, and I would say the U.S. economy ended Q1 on a solid footing. Even though this report shows that real GDP contracted 0.3% at an annualized pace, that was the first contraction in real GDP since the first quarter of 2022. But that was essentially dragged by the trade part and was expected at the first place, especially after we got the advanced international trade report. So the U.S. trade deficit jumped to a record high at least a 10% increase in March, and that concluded the first quarter with a record high trade deficit, the mean to drag on real GDP. If you know how GDP is generated by the Bureau of Economic Analysis, essentially it is the net trade, which is the difference between exports and imports that goes to GDP. And when imports surge, as importers try to beat tariff increases from the new Trump administration, the net trade will drag on growth. And if you take out the trade pieces of the GDP report and look at other pieces, consumer demand actually remained solid ending Q1. And real consumer spending rose a solid 1.8%, adding 1.2 percentage points to annualized growth. And business fixed investment rose almost 10% annualized, adding 1.3 percentage points to growth. And residential investment tied to the housing market, have been weighed by the tight monetary policy over the past couple of years, it was slightly positive for growth in Q1. So the fundamentals were generally solid, supported by the decent labor market, even though, trade had subtracted almost 5 percentage points from the GDP growth in Q1. I would say we're not in a recession right now. As, for example, if you look at the NBER standards to determine if the U.S. is in a recession or not, things like employment, consumer spending, personal income, and industrial production, those pieces point that the U.S. economy was not even close to recession in the first quarter. Much of those trade pieces was that people are rushing to buy ahead of tariffs that are expected to be short-lived. And consumer and business sentiments have fallen rapidly since President Trump's announcement of big increase in tariffs. And inflation is set to pick up even further as, tariff hikes work their way into prices. And so we say that, the U.S. economy ended Q1 on a solid footing. But we do expect GDP growth will be below 1% this year. There are a lot of risks ahead of us, and we expect economic growth to be much softer than it was in 2024. And the unemployment rate will also move to around 5% over the next year. We think, recession risks are much higher than they were at the beginning of the year, as tariffs will be a significant drag. Right now, the probability of a U.S. recession over the next year is about 40%. That is substantially up from 15% in early 2025. Even with the 40% probability, our baseline is still not a recession, but the uncertainty surrounding the tariff itself could also be a drag on the economy, could be some downside risk. With the extent of tariffs uncertain, consumers are reluctant to make big purchases, business can't make decisions about investment weighing on growth. So the higher the tariffs are, the longer they remain in place, the greater the uncertainty surrounding them, the greater the probability of recession.
Now, I have to ask you before you go, is inflation actually rising under current tariff policies? And do we expect the Fed to hold interest rates this year?
Indeed, it is a tricky situation now. The inflation did accelerate in the first quarter. You know, the Fed's preferred inflation measure, personal consumption expenditure price index, that rose 3.6% at an annualized rate, which is the fastest inflation since Q1 2023. And if you want to pick out some volatile pieces to see some of the underlying inflation trends, the core PCE price index rose 3.5%, the largest increase since the first quarter of 2024. So both of, you know, headline inflation and core inflation are well above the Federal Reserve 2% objective. We expect the FOMC to cut the Fed funds rate by 25 basis points at each of its four meetings in the second half of this year. That would bring the Fed funds rate to a range of 3.25% to 3.5% by the end of this year, because, you know, we expect the economy to be noticeably slower this year. I mean, the average effective tariff rate is at the highest level in over 100 years, and will be weighing on trade flows that took roughly 15% of the U.S. economy. Tariffs, again, is a form of tax. With tax, that will likely weigh on consumer spending or even business investment, and some uncertainties around trade policies that can be withdrawn anytime or it can be higher 90 days from now. That could also create drags on consumer spending. For example, if the declining consumer sentiments pan into a solid picture and people start to build up their precautionary savings instead of spending, that could be a drag, and prices will be higher, even though it could be a temporary shock to inflation that can still diverge inflation from the Fed target, and making uncertainty around monetary policy also higher. So I would say the Fed does face a difficult task ahead. The central bank has a dual mandate of maximum employment and stable price. Those goals may come quickly into conflict with each other. I mean, inflation picked up the first quarter, moving further above 2%, and will be even higher in the near term as tariffs lead to price hikes. But weaker growth from tariffs will contribute to a softening labor market. The Fed may face the choice of cutting rates to support the labor market, which could contribute to higher inflation, or not cutting rates to chalk off inflation, leading to higher unemployment. We have seen President Trump already ramping up some pressure on the Federal Reserve Chair Powell to cut the Fed funds rate. But I would say right now the Fed does want to see some, you know, solid evidence on some growth and inflation. And we do expect the FOMC to cut the Fed funds rate by 25 basis points at each of these four meetings in the second half of this year. So a cumulative of 100 basis point cut. And we expect the economy to be noticeably slower this year.
Well, Sean, as you've said just a few moments ago, the Fed does, in fact, face a difficult task ahead indeed. And so we are just so thankful that you, on behalf of PNC Financial Services Group, join us today to help break down everything that's happening in our economy right now, giving an economic outlook locally, statewide, and nationally. Again, we thank you for joining us, and we look forward to having you back with us next month.
Yeah, thanks for having me again, Dee. It's always a pleasure to give an update and talk to you.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Media.
More Americans than ever are expected to reach retirement age this year, but retirement confidence is actually down. According to Fidelity, 67% of pre-retirees say they're confident in their retirement plans. That's a 7% drop from last year. Rising costs, inflation, and volatile markets are a big reason why. Joining us now to share more about how retirees and near retirees can adjust to today's challenges is Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer of Hammer Financial Group, Inc. in Schererville. Greg, as always, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Thanks for having me, Dee.
Greg, let's start with the big question. Given ongoing inflation, elevated interest rates, and geopolitical volatility, how are you advising retirees to adjust their income strategies and portfolios in 2025?
Well, it's definitely been a complex year for investors, you know, especially retirees. You know, inflation still elevated, the Fed signaling, you know, higher for longer type interest rates. You know, so we're advising clients to focus on income diversification and flexibility. You know, basically, it means just looking beyond, you know, Social Security and traditional bond funds, considering things like bond ladders, dividend paying stocks, short-term treasuries for near-term needs, while still keeping some exposure to growth for the long haul.
That's a tricky balance, especially when cash yields are so attractive right now. How are you helping clients navigate that trade-off?
Well, you're right. And yields on cash and short-term bonds are the best we've seen, and I would say more than a decade, right? But retirement could last, you know, 25 to 30 years or more, and inflation won't stay still. So while we're definitely taking advantage of the cash and the bond letters in the short term, you know, we're also still carving out space for long-term growth. You know, typically, you know, with a measured allocation to equities or inflation-protected assets like, you know, real estate or TIPS, it's all about managing risk and, you know, not avoiding it completely.
So, Greg, let's talk about the market's volatility. So lately, we've heard terms like correction and bear market being thrown around. And for folks at or near retirement, what's the difference and why does that even matter?
Great question. So a correction is when the market drops 10% from recent highs. A bear market is when it drops 20% or more. So retiring into a bear market can be especially dangerous because of something called sequence of returns risk. And that's basically the idea that early losses in retirements while you're withdrawing money, so combined withdrawals, can have a lasting impact on how long your savings will last.
So, Greg, so even if the market does in fact recover later, those early losses can do damage, right?
Yeah, let me give you a simple example. Let's say somebody has $1 million saved. They experience a 50% drop early in retirement. Well, they're now at $500,000. Even if the market bounces back 50%, they're still only at $750,000. So you actually need a 100% gain to fully recover a 50% loss. And that's without even accounting for the withdrawals. So if people are withdrawing during that time period, then the money in those accounts doesn't have the chance to recover. That's why it's so important, you know, to position assets for purpose.
Wow. You know, that example really puts things into perspective. So how do you protect against that?
Well, here's where the good news comes in. There are strategies that can help. Some key ones, including, you know, having at least a year's worth of expense, you know, your expenses in cash. So you're not forced to sell assets in a down market. We actually recommend that even having that, you know, money earmarked for the income need for up to 5 to 8, maybe even 10 years. You know, delaying withdrawals if possible, maybe even working part-time to reduce pressure on the portfolio if you weren't prepared for it, right? Using more conservative or guaranteed income instruments as you near retirement, natural evolution for most folks, developing a smart tax strategy, which will help reduce, you know, what you owe once you start beginning withdrawals. And most importantly, the biggest thing is not letting fear or emotions drive decisions. You know, emotional selling is one of the biggest pitfalls, you know, we try to help retirees avoid because, you know, when the market volatility occurs, still the same rules. You don't want to sell out when the market's down.
Now, what about diversification, Greg? You've talked before about how it's more than just owning a lot of stocks.
Yeah, you know, true diversification means holding assets that behave differently in various types of market environments. You know, this could include stocks, bonds, cash, real estate, maybe even annuities or alternative investments, depending on the person's goals. The goal is to have parts of your portfolio performing even when others aren't, so that you're not entirely exposed to one type of risk.
Greg, before I let you go, I do have one final question. So with all of the talk of tariffs, recession, and political instability, should people be revisiting their retirement plans right now?
Absolutely. I mean, even without these, retirement plan, you know, it isn't set it and forget it. It's a living document. You know, now's the perfect time to check in on your risk tolerance, revisit your income needs, stress test your plan, you know, under different types of market conditions. The more proactive you are, the less reactive you'll need to be when the headlines get scary.
You know, Greg, as always, we enjoy having you join us on Regionally Speaking because you break it all down in a way that's so easy to understand and digest. Again, we thank you for joining us and we look forward to having you back with us next month.
Hey, thanks for having me. It was always a pleasure, Dee.
That was Greg Hammer, President and CEO of Hammer Financial Group in Schererville. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Media.
Legacy Foundation is Lake County's community foundation. For over 30 years, we've partnered with donors and nonprofits, focusing on youth development, the arts, the environment, health, literacy, and other causes that matter to you. We're committed to Lake County forever. First Things First, Porter County is dedicated to supporting families, healthy beginnings, and quality early learning, ensuring every Porter County baby is born prepared for a strong start in life. Learn more at firstthingspc.org.
I have a very strong connection to other students. Everyone makes an effort to help each other. I'll remember the feeling of being here, the feeling that I was a part of a family.
Learn more at pnw.edu.
Additional support for Building Blocks is provided generously by Tom Sorlis and Sue Eleuterio, as well as Porter County Community Foundation, serving Porter County since 1996.
Building Blocks, the podcast, a co-production of Lakeshore Public Media and First Things First Porter County, is dedicated to exploring the science of early childhood development and addressing the challenges that Northwest Indiana encounters. Dr. Mary Jane Eisenhower, Executive Director of First Things First Porter County, explores the vast world of early childhood development as she welcomes local experts, parents, and practitioners to discuss the building blocks for brain and language development. Here's Mary Jane Eisenhower with more.
Hi. Today I'm talking with Rachel Liske, speech-language pathologist here in Northwest Indiana. And we're going to be talking about language development, developmental milestones, motherhood, and everything in between. Welcome to Building Blocks.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here with you.
This is a lot of fun because we share this background in speech and language pathology. So tell us how you landed with that and all of those letters behind your name as a professional here in Northwest Indiana.
Okay. Well, I love telling this story, and I will do my best not to get emotional about it, but generally I do get a little weepy. So I am a Valpo resident, born and raised, left for school, came home. In high school, at Valpo High School, we have a program called, well, it was called peer tutoring. It's currently called, I think it's called Life Skills now. So any Valpo High School students, you can come correct me later. But we had peer tutoring, and it was an opportunity from like junior and senior year. You gave up your homeroom so that you could go work in the classroom with the kiddos. And so like the special needs kids. So I did that junior year, and I don't know if we like purposely got matched up, but I got matched up with this very, very special person in my heart who I still kind of keep in touch with the family today, but she was my girl. Like she, I called her, I won't say her name for privacy purposes, but she was my girl and everybody knew it. And I got to go to the classroom with her. Sometimes I'd go to speech with her. And one day it was one of those speech days and I got to go with her and some of her other buddies who were going to speech for the day, which shout out to the school speech paths. You guys are literally some of the best humans in the entire world. So we're in speech. She's doing her thing, but I've got my ear on one of the other students because once you love one, you love them all. The speech path was working on him getting a sound for like the first time. She had peanut butter and the popsicle stick, right? She sticks that peanut butter right behind his teeth. We were working on like T's and D's. That kid said a T for like the first time. And her eyes lit up and the way that his did, I was hooked. I'm like, if I can do something like this and like help bring joy to a kid and recognize that we can give everybody a voice, I want to do that for my whole life. So
you knew from a pretty young age that this was where you wanted to be.
Yeah.
That's really special.
Mm-hmm. I was super lucky to have that opportunity. And Tina Morales is the head special ed teacher at the high school. And she is, again, one of the most amazing humans. And so I'm really lucky that I got to be with her.
And there is something about working with young children and just other humans. Mm-hmm. And when the light bulb goes on or it clicks, it's magic.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it takes special people like you to make that happen. Oh. So tell me, what's involved when you are learning to be a speech-language pathologist?
So first things first, we go, well, I mean, things are kind of changing these days, but in my experience, First, you go get your undergrad. And I went to Indiana University Bloomington, did the undergrad with speech and hearing sciences, and then I just immediately knew grad school was the next step. Some people will do their undergrad and maybe want to go into the schools right away because you can, with your undergraduate degree, be a speech language assistant mm-hmm. in the public schools. Just for me, how my parents did their education and how like all my family did, it was like, okay, cool. You do your 4 years and then you go to grad school. So I applied to grad school like many of my other classmates and went right off. So then I did another almost 2 year program up at Northwestern University in Evanston and got to have the experience with working with adults, working with kids. And I think even my supervisor, like day one, she was like, yeah, I know you're going to do this adult stuff, but we all know that you want to work with the kids. And
that's great. And you know, that's part of my story too. I started at Northwestern in speech and language pathology.
Yeah. I don't think I knew that.
That was...
So we're Wildcats together?
Go Cats.
Oh my gosh.
I bleed purple. I don't know about you, but
what?
Yes.
That's
and cool. Just being in that language lab, we both know what that looks like. Mm-hmm. And that was my passion for three-year-olds. Came
oh
from that very experience. So I understand that magic and when that happens. Mm-hmm. And it's not just the child, but it's also their family.
Yes. Yeah. I was really lucky to get to like work with them. I remember two of the parents came in for one of like our classes, right? Like, let's hear from parents about what early intervention is.
Sure.
And that's what it's called in Illinois. It's EI. We have First Steps in Indiana. But so I got to meet two of these EI moms and then come to find out they were super close with my supervisor. So then I got to like go see those kids outside of the school element, and I got to babysit and I got to nanny for one of them. And even that connection, like getting to see what these kids need outside of a 45-minute therapy session or how I'm supposed to create a soap note. Like I just got to have that real life exposure, which made learning about language development and how there are so many areas, it just made it so much more like rich, and I actually could apply it.
That's right.
Better.
And that real life experience. So mm-hmm. soap note, that may be an unfamiliar term.
Soap note is like our treatment plan.
Okay.
And if you know me, you know I'm not the best at those things because I just like to get in and just see what we're going to do for the day.
See what's up with these children. Yes.
Yes.
That's fantastic. And I think you're right. There's so much more to it. I know some of the misperceptions that people have about the field of speech and language is, you know, it's a lot of working on articulation and sounds and letters or language development, but there's so much more. Tell us other areas, if especially people who are interested in the field
yes.
might want to explore.
Holy moly. Okay. So we of course have like the old school Artic where like the idea is you're sitting at a table and you just drill flashcards. We don't need flashcards. Just pick up something real life. I'd rather a kid know that an apple is an apple, not a picture of an apple. So yes, we can work on articulation. We can work on apraxia of speech. I know that word's kind of getting tossed around a little bit more. So yes, we have apraxia. We can work on myofunctional therapy. That is a newer topic near and dear to my heart. Just really thinking about how the muscles of the face impact our airway. Airway-centric therapists are very, very integral, I think, in making sure when we look at a whole child or a whole adult, right? Mm. I always talk in terms of children.
And that's what we're talking about today is children.
Yes. But, you know, whole child, we can't isolate one area of development from another. We can work on...
I want to hear the airflow. Yeah. Like, big deal. What does that mean? I'm breathing. I'm in and out.
Yes. Okay. So how we breathe matters. Humans are obligate nose breathers. And if we're not breathing from our nose, we got to figure out the why. And I'm super lucky because the women that I work with, we are all, again, whole child therapists. We are always thinking about the root cause of issues. We don't like to treat symptoms. We want to get to the root of the problem. And if we can't figure it out, we're going to go find the person who can.
Okay.
So there are so many more like-minded professionals that are just coming up into our area, Northwest Indiana. There's more access to this type of like objective education on why, how we breathe matters. And you don't have to go up to Chicago to the hospital. You don't have to go to Indy for the hospital. We've got some really, really stellar professionals in Northwest Indiana now.
So this is intriguing to me. How do you teach someone to breathe differently?
Oh, my
and why,
word
why,
alive.
Why does that matter, more importantly?
Okay, so, I mean, if we think about it, breathing is our most important function. If you cannot breathe, you cannot function. So we think about the quality of airflow, and I'm going to be real careful with what I say because I'm still learning.
Okay.
Nobody knows it all, and I am the first one to say that. But we're thinking about how, I don't know, like you think about a palate, right? The roof of your mouth. The roof of your mouth is the floor of your nose. That's connected.
It's all connected.
It's all connected. Everything is connected. You cannot isolate one thing from another. So we think about how our airway affects how we eat, how we sleep, mm-hmm. how we think. Mm-hmm. It all impacts how I'm a speech path. And if I'm one who really wants to help impact a kiddo, it's my job to share this knowledge.
Sure.
And the knowledge is always growing. Again, I don't know everything. I'm just excited to keep learning and learning from the people who have made this their like life goal.
Absolutely.
I'm just coming along to learn because I think it's a big missing piece.
Okay.
That we are just scraping the surface.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I know, for example, in my experience, and I didn't continue on with my education because at the time, dating myself a long time ago, it was very siloed. It was very much in isolation. We weren't looking at the whole child. And that's mm-hmm. really what I knew I wanted to be doing. So I took a different pathway. But I know at the time we talked a lot about like swallowing and feeding. And those are some mm-hmm. of the things that you also work on.
I do. Yes. That was one of my favorite things in grad school was to get to go do like the swallow studies.
Yes.
And I was very fortunate. I had one of my current kiddos let me tag along for a swallow study last summer. We got to go up to a hospital, and I got to sit there and watch. Holy moly, have I forgotten a lot? I'm looking, and I'm like, oh, yeah, they look great. I'm not seeing any aspiration penetration. And then we get it back in the speech pass, like, oh, yeah, no, we're still doing some of this stuff,
Rach. Still working on those
things. You got to hone those cues. But yeah, swallowing's a big one. I've got a couple feeding kiddos right now that we work not only on just the motoric ability of like how can food go from your mouth to your throat to your tummy, but are we even okay with food being in our vicinity? Can we tolerate looking at it, smelling it, touching it? There's more to eating than just food goes in the mouth.
And that's huge for parents.
Yes,
I know that is such a worry for so many parents about what is my child eating? They're not mm-hmm. eating. They're eating this. They're not eating that. And wow, there is a lot that goes into that. So it's wonderful to know that there is support and help for that.
Yes. And I would say one of the biggest benefits or maybe just a big support for families is letting your child play in food. And that even means making some messes sometimes.
Uh-oh, not messes.
I know, God forbid I say the word mess and I just see some parents' eyes just either go real wide or like, okay, get this lady out of here.
What does that look like? When you're saying like, oh, it's okay, let your child play mm-hmm. with food.
It can mean we are going to put them in their high chair and we are just going to open that fridge door and pull out the condiments and just spray and play. And it's going to get in your hands and in your hair and probably in your nose. But that is play. Messy play is brain play. The more we play with our food, that we get it on our hands, on our face, on our clothes even, you have to be aware. You know when people say, oh, you got a little something on your face. You have to feel that. If you don't, then you could go walking around with SpaghettiOs on your face all day.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And they're delicious, but you don't want them on your face all day. We need kids to know that food isn't, again, just to go in the mouth and fill your belly. It's for nutrition, but it's also for like socialization. You know what it's like when you want to go meet your friend for a favorite food or even just make one of your favorite foods at home.
Yes.
That's a question I ask families all the time. What is your favorite food? And they'll tell me, and I'm like, don't you want to be able to eat that with your kid? And of course, the answer is always yes, but they feel like we're never going to get there. There's no way they can do that.
Interesting.
But they can because parents are our best teachers.
And it's such a cultural experience. Like, this is our family's culture. This is how we operate as a family. We always have this particular food at this holiday.
Mm-hmm.
So how might you help a family look through that? Or what can families be doing from the time of birth to start building up that culture of feeding and food in their families?
Having a kiddo sitting at the table with you anytime you are eating is a great introduction. You know what it's like when you're eating one of your favorite foods. You're happy. Like, I know when I'm eating tacos, I am just sitting there doing
the dance,
my little dance going. Mm-hmm. My Claire Bear does it too. And you want to know that food brings joy. food should bring joy.
Sure.
And babies pick up on your emotions from day one. They're picking up on how you're feeling. So you're in the kitchen cooking. You've got the music going. I want your baby right there with you.
Absolutely.
Letting them know that there are processes to mealtime, that we got to get out the pots and pans. We got to pull out the veggies from the fridge. We got to do some chopping. Food just doesn't appear out of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
You let your baby see what happens. They start to develop an expectation, anticipation, excitement. And then, ooh, if mama's eating it, I want to eat it too.
Of course. Of course. And there's, you know, I think there's just so much information for parents out there about like the right time to start foods. And I imagine that's different for every baby.
Yes.
So we can't give any specific guidelines. But
correct.
How do families know these things? Where do you find that information out? What is...
I would say when it comes to kind of how you're saying like specific guidelines, you can Google everything and everybody's going to tell you a different number.
Right.
You should do this at X amount of months. You should do this at X amount of months. What me and my colleagues share with families, like for example, if we're doing first steps assessments or if we're doing that initial eval at the clinic, we want to make sure that a child's body is ready to eat.
Okay.
And what that readiness looks like is postural support, is making sure that hydration status is appropriate. And I'm saying this and I'm already like, I know someone's out there like, well, what about our kiddos who aren't oral feeders? Rachel, you got to remember that. And I know, I promise, I'm speaking in generalities right now, but I will loop back. A big takeaway, your kids got to be able to sit up when they are able. Again, I'm putting these asterisks.
Every baby's going to be different.
Every baby's different. But as long as our babies are able to sit up and support themselves, then we know that the trunk can support the mouth.
Uh-huh.
Because feeding stems from the trunk. If we're weak in our belly, we're weak in our mouth.
Yeah, it's not just about your face and your mouth.
Just shove food in a kid's mouth. Many families say, well, we give this food to them and they spit it out. Well, guess what? Your kid also is still working on stabilizing their muscles because they won't know. Their tongue doesn't know what to do if their tummy doesn't. And when I say tummy, I mean like trunk support and like core stability and that.
All of those muscles. That's so exciting.
It's a lot. There's so much and we can get so nerdy, but it's also because it's a lot learning. And I'm always learning this, like how much do I share at one time?
Of course.
I'm a lot. I tend to just try to give it all at one time and I know it's too much sometimes. So there are some really awesome resources out there that can give us more of a guideline of, okay, well, you want to try this food. Here are some ideas how.
Mm-hmm.
Am I allowed to say like a recommendation for an app?
Sure.
Okay. There's a really great one that I personally love. It's called Solid Starts.
Okay.
It's a free app and it's obviously a website as well, but it was created by five super awesome smart women, a pediatrician, a gastroenterologist, occupational therapist, speech path, and a nutritionist.
So the whole team.
The whole team. Again, whole approach. It's not just pick a food and go with it, but they create videos, like real-time videos of kids at certain ages eating foods presented in certain ways. Tiny bites aren't always good.
Okay.
Solid Starts kind of shares the background and the safety around choking. Sometimes if our bites are too small, that can lead to a choking hazard. So it's definitely more of the baby-led weaning style.
Okay.
And again, it gives specific like visuals. This is how old your kid is. Give food this size.
This size.
This is a food you want to try. Here you go. We'll walk you through it.
Wonderful.
It's great. And then it's less of I'm telling you what to do. I am just simply giving you one resource, but you can pick and you can go through and filter and you can isolate any allergens because so many of our kids are allergic to foods. We can't just say, oh, just go pick whatever you want. There's health and safety are priority, and this is a way to do that.
That's terrific.
Yeah.
So I'm talking today with speech-language pathologist Rachel Liske, and we're talking about all the wonderful things with children's development around feeding and swallowing, but also just being a mom and understanding what resources are available. Rachel, you mentioned first steps, and I know that that's a big part of your professional obligation. Mm-hmm. Tell us what is first steps and why would families want to interact with first steps?
First steps is our state's early intervention. We support kids from the day they're born till the day before their third birthday. I'm going to say that again. We can start the day they're born. We can offer supports for a range of concerns, from eating concerns, sleeping concerns, mobility concerns, and communication is a very common one. But families can find our website. You can go to firststeps.org, talking with other moms and other trusted adults, moms and dads, trusted adults. Many of our local pediatricians Absolutely. Are becoming so much more aware and just kind of sharing like, hey, First Steps is out there, but there's still work to do. There are many families that when I go into the home with one of my colleagues as like a as an assessment team member, first visit, they're over two and they're like, I had no idea you guys existed. Why didn't anyone tell me about this? And that just always kind of like kills us a little bit because it's like, we're here.
Sure.
We've been here for years. So if I can shout it from the rooftops, if you have any kind of questions about your kid's development, you can start a referral. Parents start the referral. You don't need our pediatricians, and God love our pediatricians. Ours are the best and I love them. But they're doing enough. Or not, they do a ton all day long, right? So you don't need a pediatrician to start the process.
So would walk me through that. I'm a mom. Actually, my family used First Steps for one of our children.
Yeah.
So I understand the process. But for those out there who may not be familiar, I know in our case, we weren't clear. I knew a little thing about child development, and my little one wasn't crawling and wasn't moving.
Oh, yeah.
So what would you tell me?
I would say let's get on the First Steps website and do an online referral form.
Okay.
You write down your identifying info, your contact info, and an email, and then your concerns. And then somebody from our First Steps office, and so for our area in Cluster A, our office is in Crown Point. We've got some of the best service coordinators and case supporters. And then somebody contacts you directly, and we go through an intake process.
Intake process.
That's going to be a lot of paperwork going through all the nuts and bolts, you know, your address, your family history, your concerns, where you live.
The language that you speak?
Yes. Yes, mm-hmm. Absolutely. The familiar language is very important. And then they'll say, okay, like we can get you set up. And we'll schedule an assessment for you. And then two of our colleagues would come and do an in-home assessment.
Okay.
We also offer virtual assessments. Many families request virtual, even to this day, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we have all options. We can meet you at a library. We can meet you at a park. We can meet you at your home. We can meet you. We will come to you.
Okay.
We literally want to come and help in any way we can.
All right.
These services are available. They're open to everybody. Every single person in the state of Indiana, we are here to help.
Okay.
So firststeps.org, fill out your referral form, and someone will contact you.
And then the team shows up?
The team shows up. We do a roughly 90-minute assessment. We use our own standardized tool. It looks at global development. So any concerns that you bring, we will absolutely address them. We're going to answer your questions. We're going to offer the resources while also remembering you can't isolate one area development from another. Whole child. So we look at global developmental skills. And then we talk about, based on our standardized test, not to get too nerdy about it, but in order to qualify for First Steps, you either show a 25% delay in one of six areas or a 20% delay in two of the areas.
So what might, give me an example what that might look like, a 25% delay in one area.
So each kiddo is scored with their same aged peers. So let's say I have a 18-month-old assessment and we're running through our test and the family's concerns are speech related.
Mm-hmm.
So we go through our whole test, we score it up. And if the kiddo, we have like our score sheet, I mean,
sure.
for those who are with me on assessment team, they're like, oh, Rachel shouldn't be explaining this part, but you know,
but you're part of a team that goes through this.
We're part of a team. Yes. And this is objective data.
Yes.
First Steps isn't about just someone's opinion or assumption. We use objective data to determine if a kiddo meets criteria for First Steps. If they meet criteria, then the family has a third meeting. So I guess that first step that I mentioned, the intake process, that's step one. Step two, assessment team members come out and come play.
Mm-hmm.
I say the word play. It should look like play.
It does look like play.
It better.
That's right. And it's not a test like we think of for grown-ups or
Correct.
Even for third graders. This is a test for your... A test. This is an observation. This is interaction.
Yes.
Let's try these things out. What happens when I roll a ball to you, 18-month-old? You roll it back to me, maybe you don't.
Right.
Maybe there's some utterances or some language around that. Mm-hmm. And so that's what the team is watching for and scoring, like
yes.
you say.
Yep. Play-based assessment. We ask parents so many questions, but we're really careful to say, please know we're asking because you are the professional in your child.
Right.
Nobody knows your better baby. Nobody knows your baby better than you. Mm-hmm. We're just here because we get a snapshot. We get to come in and we get to see one time. So we ask you questions so that we make sure we represent your kiddo to the best of our ability when we write up the assessment.
So the assessment gets written up and it's determined that this child may need some support. The family might need some ideas, some support. What happens next?
Then the family has a third meeting and they go back. They go to their service coordinator. Service coordinator is your go-to for all things first steps. You and the service coordinator sit down and you make a plan. You make a plan. You parents drive the services. Your concerns drive your services. So you talk about, well, these are my goals. I want my kiddo to be able to tell me when they're hungry. Okay. I want my kiddo to be able to walk up the stairs. Okay, we're going to put plans and goals in place and providers in place who can address those specific concerns.
And so what does that look like? That plan gets put in place. What happens next?
Our service coordinators are always kind of working in the background, making sure that when we even know that concerns are being presented, they're already reaching out to our local First Steps clinics and reaching out to available providers who can go see.
And that happens in the home then? That
yes.
continues, those services continue in the home?
They continue in what we call the natural environment.
Okay.
Which can include home, but it can also include a park, a library, a grocery store. I have done First Step sessions at the grocery store.
Okay.
It's awesome. You can go to Starbucks. It's wherever the kiddo might need support, where the parent might need support.
Sure.
We have lots of trusted adults who are like, we don't leave the house.
We don't leave.
We don't. It's too stressful. And then in my brain, I'm like, ooh, okay, let's go do it together. I will be here with you. You're not going to do this by yourself. I'll be that extra set of hands. I'll be that extra idea where it's like, okay, this is where we're going to melt down. Let's do A, B, and C first and see if we can make it a little easier.
Of course.
Because First Steps is family-centered.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, like the kiddo is the name on the piece of paper, but it's the whole family unit.
It is the whole family unit.
We got to support
them. And how wonderful. And you're talking about this is happening when children are 6 months old, the day after they get home from the hospital.
Yes.
It's so important to start early.
Yes, don't wait. Trust your intuition. Your gut is your best friend. So when you feel like something's going on, don't let somebody talk you out of it. This is a voluntary program. You can call us or email anytime you want.
Mm-hmm.
And let's say there are some instances where we come out, we do our initial assessment. Kiddo isn't showing. They're not meeting criteria. Okay, let's come back in 2 or 3 months. We're still here. Just because you do one initial assessment with First Steps and the kid doesn't qualify doesn't mean you can't come call us back anytime from birth to 3. We are here.
So much more to talk about, Rachel. We'll have to have you back. But for now, is there any just advice, one piece of advice you can give to families right now as we wrap up?
Turn off the TV and sit down on the floor with your kid.
I love that advice. Thank you so much for your time, for being here today. You are a wonderful resource, wonderful. I can only imagine the joy that families and children have when you show up at their door with all of your things. And the fun that it must be to spend time with you. So
thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Building Blocks, the podcast, is a co-production of Lakeshore Public Media and First Things First Porter County. For more information on Building Blocks, including this podcast, as well as the television show, visit lakeshorepublicmedia.org/buildingblocks.
Legacy Foundation is Lake County's community foundation. For over 30 years, we've partnered with donors and nonprofits, focusing on youth development, the arts, the environment, health, literacy, and other causes that matter to you. We're committed to Lake County forever.
First Things First Border County is dedicated to supporting families, healthy beginnings, and quality early learning, ensuring every Porter County baby is born prepared for a strong start in life. Learn more at firstthingspc.org.
I have a very strong connection to other students. Everyone makes an effort to help each other. I remember the feeling of being here, the feeling that I was a part of a family.
Learn more at pnw.edu.
Additional support for Building Blocks is provided generously by Tom Sorlis and Sue Eleuterio, as well as Porter County Community Foundation, serving Porter County since 1996.
The Bishop of Gary is calling the election of the first American Pope a great joy for the whole church, but particularly for the greater Chicagoland and Northwest Indiana area. Lakeshore Public Media's Michael Gallenberger reports.
Lori discussed the election of Pope Leo XIV in a Diocese of Gary Facebook video Thursday.
We have a new Holy Father, and praise the Lord, one who's from Chicagoland, who grew up right where we are.
The bishop urged the faithful to keep the new pope in their prayers.
Take some time to celebrate tonight, but make sure you offer an Our Father, a Hail Mary, a Glory Be for our new Pope Leo.
Robert Prevost was born in Chicago and grew up in Dalton. For Lakeshore News, I'm Michael Gallenberger.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for this week. Thanks to our guests from PNC Financial Services Group, Ersheng Leong, and from Hammer Financial Group, President and CEO Greg Hammer. And we'll be back with you next week with an all-new show.